30th, that's the act.
2001.
2001, yes. It is 2001, isn't it? And my only question is there a space odyssey?
We're on it.
What we're going to do, committee and public people, is we're going to have a hearing on House Bill 2354. And if it becomes a desire of the committee to move that on out, we can. And then we're going to have a hearing on 2517. And we'll go from there. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2354. And Matt, give us a little rundown on this, please.
House Bill 2354 requires private collection agencies collecting state funds to follow the same confidentiality standard as the state agency they're collecting the funds for. This bill was referred to the committee, or was referred to the speaker originally by the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee, and was referred then to this committee, Government Efficiency.
Thank you. Does it carry a subsequent referral, or does it?
No.
No.
No, sir, it does not.
Okay, good. Let's see, with that, I'm going to just follow the list here as far as people that I have to testify at this point. John Dufresne?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And Steve, did you want to come up with him?
Okay.
Oh, all three of you coming up to him? Well, makes our job easy. Please make sure that you state your name for the record whenever you speak, and just go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Dufresne. I'm coordinator for the statewide accounts receivable management program. On my right is Steve Little with the Department of Revenue. On my left is Barbara Hunter with the Department of Employment, or Employment Department. House Bill 2354, there's a committee called the Accounts Receivable Core Committee, which is a committee of state agencies that meets twice a month and looks at various issues regarding state collection and accounts receivable policies. Following House Bill 3509's 1999 passage, the committee looked at some housekeeping issues and other issues. Two of those are the ones that you find in the bill that were sent on to Senator Bryant as suggestions for housekeeping, and he included those. The first one, identified in Section 1, adds a term confidentiality to the standard of service and courtesy that are to be provided by private collection firms in the same manner, if you will, as the state agencies. The confidentiality of data between state agencies varies. Some of this information, obviously, has gone through a judicial process and is public record. Other of it, for instance, income tax is a bit more confidential. So we want the private collection agencies to be aware of that. Major confidentiality should be addressed when they're performing their collection activity. The second piece of this is the Department of Revenue was listed in statute as the person, as the entity that is to do the collection on subsequently collectible accounts. ORS 293245 says that when an account is written off, it is written off only for financial statement, financial purposes, not for legal purposes. So they become still a legal debt that could be collected. And should some type of event show that the collectibility returns, we are saying that the state agency should be responsible for that collectibility rather than the Department of Revenue. I'll turn it over to Steve Little.
Good morning, Chair Crummell and members of the committee. My name is Steve Little, representing the Oregon Department of Revenue. And indeed, the two issues of this bill are relatively important to the Department of Revenue. Certainly confidentiality of the information that taxpayers provide us is of utmost importance to us. And it is also recognized by the legislature in the stiff penalties and possible jail sentences for disclosure of that information on the part of our employees. Now, we do have contractual relationships with private collection agencies and have some 40,000 accounts and $40 million currently out at private collection. And that information needs to be protected by them equally as well as it is by persons in the Department of Revenue. In regard to the other issue of the assignment or to the Department of Revenue for the responsibility of collecting that debts that had been determined to be uncollectible by the Secretary of State. In 1991, the legislature passed, at the request of the Secretary of State and the Department of Revenue, a bill that ended the practice of needing to send accounts to the Department of Revenue for collection after write-off. And part of the reason of that was nearly all of those accounts had already been at the Department of Revenue at our other agency accounts unit, and we had determined the uncollectibility. And so we got into a somewhat of a revolving door thing where we determined them uncollectible, sent them back to the agency. They then asked the Secretary of State to certify uncollectibility, and then it was returned to the Department of Revenue. And it became an administrative burden. There was no value. We never found any of these counts subsequently to be collectible, and they just started collecting in books, and we would go through them, and there was a cost that was far exceeded anything that the state could gain back in value of collections. And so what we did, though, is we, in working in the Accounts Receivable Court Committee, looking at all these laws, identified that, whoops, there's this one piece in the law that still referenced the Department of Revenue for receiving these accounts after we had had the law change that ended the practice of the state agencies sending them to us. And so this is kind of a housekeeping piece to take care of that. And I will turn it over to Barbara Hunter on my left.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Cromwell and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Hunter. I'm an assistant director of workforce programs at the Employment Department. House Bill 2354 imposes the same duty of confidentiality on private collection agencies that it currently places on state agencies. The confidentiality of records really is essential to the proper and efficient administration of Employment Department services and programs. Therefore, one of the most important duties that our employees have is to protect the privacy of those who get services from us. To that end, we train our employees in confidentiality, and we're all expecting them to preserve the confidentiality of our customers. Now, the law is fairly specific about what happens when someone improperly discloses confidential information. That is, ORS 657-665 talks about disclosing information, and it says that someone who does that may not hold any appointment or employment or performance perform any service under contract with a state agency employing that person or officer. The U.S. Department of Labor also interprets federal law to say that employment insurance information is confidential, with some exceptions. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, individuals who claim benefits really may be discouraged from exercising their rights if they believe that that information would be disclosed. And the second thing is we rely on a lot of information from employers to really properly administer the program. If they feel that that information will be disclosed, that will discourage them from providing that information. We're currently embracing the use of private collection firms. We want them to help us collect unemployment insurance benefits, overpayments, and we also want them to help us collect employer delinquent unemployment insurance taxes. So as a result, it's very important that private collection agencies and their staff really maintain the same strict confidential standards that we use. And we believe that House Bill 2354 would help in that regard. So I really thank you for your careful consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee for Representative Hill?
Thank you. Is there a reason why you can't put this in contract today in terms of these collection agencies on confidentiality? I'm just...
Chair Cromwell, Representative Hill, we have put it into the contract. However, this is a reinforcement of the responsibilities of the state agencies. Many of us, or some of us, I should say, have within our own confidentiality statutes the requirement that those contracting with us also treat the information as confidential. Many of the agencies also, the small agencies, do not have those same provisions.
Additional
follow-up?
So has there ever been a problem with someone releasing confidential information?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Hill, the potential exists continually, and we did have a situation when we were doing the contract that inadvertently one of the collection agents in presenting information show in the contract specifying how they would present the information had used information that was confidential that had been provided by the Department of Revenue, and we recognized then that we needed a reinforcement to that confidentiality to ensure that that didn't happen again. We subsequently destroyed all of those prepared documents, and I believe we reissued the contract in order to get it corrected.
Another follow-up?
Sure, Representative Hill.
And then, I mean, we've heard from the Employment Division in terms of the statute that covers what the consequences of release mm-hmm. of confidentiality, confidential information is, in terms of, is there a statute that sort of is a blanket statute that covers the release of confidentiality and the consequences thereof? I mean, or is it, you know, other agencies, if they don't bother to write it into the contract, there's a consequence, and they're, you know, they're held to the same standard, and there is no standard or there is no consequence in statute, so it's sort of a hollow, you know, keep it confidential, but oh well. So I'm just curious in terms of why there isn't a provision for a blanket, you know, consequence for the release of confidential information.
Chair Crummell, Representative Hill, I honestly don't know, and I think we could gather that information if necessary. In the Department of Revenue's law at 314.835, there is a discussion of our own confidentiality, and then there's another section that allows us to contract and makes that requirement. Again, it's probably for the agencies whose primary business is not administering tax programs and collecting taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, the contract again is designed on a large scale basis to try and facilitate all levels of state government, from again the Department of Revenue, who has more stricter confidentiality requirements, to those that do not. In the administration of the contract, there is a section that discusses the types of disclosures that would be permitted, and so from that perspective we've kind of identified or provide the opportunity for the state agency to identify what would be permissible disclosures and what would not. In terms of the consequences, I think we'd have to look to each of the individual statutes to see what consequences there are on an agency by agency basis, and we can do that if the committee would like.
Representative Brown.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. If a person or an employer fails to pay the state of Oregon and they're turned over to a collection agency, does that information become part of their credit record then, or is the confidentiality keep that from becoming a part of their credit record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, in the contract agreement, the contract, if you will, has some areas where there's somewhat of what we'll call a cafeteria plan, again, to facilitate the varying needs of the agencies. And in this particular area, the contract is structured so that the agreement that ties the state agency and the private collection firm together references the contract. Specifically, I believe it's at section 7.2.9 in the contract, to what types of disclosure would be permitted. And one of the disclosures that is specifically mentioned is credit bureau. So it would be the duty of the agency to tell the private collection firm in the agreement that ties the contract to the state agency and the private collection firm what types of disclosure would be permittable. So by each agency, they would identify what their needs are. So for instance, the motor carriers, whose process is a very open kind of process, everyone can look this information up, They say, please provide this information to credit bureaus, where the Department of Revenue, I believe, position is to not disclose that information to credit bureaus. So again, it varies by state agency, and that's one of the specific instructions that state agencies were told to place in that agreement.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Is the information shared between each state agency then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, again, that would be on an agency-by-agency basis. The confidentiality laws predicated on each agency would allow or not allow the amount of discussion that could be provided between agencies. For instance, the Department of Motor Vehicles licensing information is sometimes shared through a process. Some employment records laws, some of the information from child support such is a protected information and cannot be shared.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Cruz.
Yeah, you just brought up something. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if a state agency contracts for collection of a bad debt, that debt is collected, child support enforcement would be precluded from discovering that information, as maybe if this person also is in arrears in child support and suddenly he's solvent and they don't know it, this would be a way for them to track that. And in this, they couldn't do that? Or is it just go the other way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, exactly. It goes the other way. The child support enforcement has probably the more beneficial laws, if you will, in that regard than some of the other agencies.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, wait before you go. I do have one question, and that is with regards to, a lot of times or sometimes we'll find agencies, people using confidentiality sort of as a curtain to protect them, or not even to protect them, but to keep from disclosing information that otherwise might be disclosable. Will this create that kind of a curtain, or will it still be, that information that needs to be shared can be shared?
Mr. Chair, I believe that this is, I see it kind of as a twofold item. Number one, it clearly identifies to private collection firms and allows the state agencies to say, this is the range of information that you're permitted to share. This is the standard for providing information to others, and for discussing that information. For instance, the Department of Revenue, you sign an agreement with them, and for the rest of your life, you're not allowed to discuss whose returns you looked at while you were involved in that program. So it kind of sets that range. And number two, it obviously provides Oregonians with some measure of confidentiality to let them know that not only will the state agency be concerned with the disclosure of that information, that they're passing on that concern to private collection firms, and again, places some limitations, not to make it any type of veil of secrecy, but to maintain that same level of confidentiality between the state agency and the private collection firm that's collecting the debt.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hill.
Do we need an emergency clause or an effective date? Because otherwise it's going to affect, assuming it passes January 1.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, that is a very good idea.
Okay. So are you saying that, yes, you would like to add which an emergency clause or an effective date?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Beck.
Do we need to do that through an amendment? Can we do that here, or this question would be, do you want to try to move this bill out today or let them get that over in the Senate, or do we want to hold it? Unless we can add, an emergency clause? We can do that.
Thank you. Representative Hill, you were nodding your head. We can.
Yeah, I'd suggest if we go into work session, we could move this out.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2354? I don't have anybody else on my list. Seeing none, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2354. And I'll go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2354.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
I move that we conceptually amend House Bill 2354 and add an emergency clause effective on passage.
I do know that we, thank you, Representative Hill. Representative Hill has moved that we add a conceptual amendment to add an emergency clause for House Bill 2354 to go into effect immediately upon its passage, and that we move it to the floor.
No, he didn't do that.
Not yet.
No, just add the conceptual amendment. Okay. Is there any discussion? The only point that I would bring up is that I know that our chief clerk has asked us not to conceptually amend it in committee, but to rather get the dash in the
middle. Mr. Okay. You are the chair of the committee, and you can do what you want.
That's true. with that, then, hearing no objections, the amendment is added conceptually. Representative Hill?
Mr. Chair, new House Bill 2354 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved by Representative Hill to move House Bill 2354 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Hill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2354 as amended be placed on the consent agenda.
Representative Hill moves House Bill 2354 as amended be placed on the consent calendar of the House. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2354. And now we will go into public hearing on House Bill 2517. Representative Cruz, did you want to, while you're going down, I tell you what,
I'm going to do it from here.
Oh, you're going to do it from here?
Yeah.
Before we do that, though, Matt, would you give us a rundown on this bill, please?
I'll leave most of the explaining to Representative Cruz, but House Bill 2517 holds a building inspector strictly liable for injury, death, or property damage that results from a failure to detect a building code violation at the time of final inspection. The bill holds this liability only, it applies only to structural conditions that were subject to inspection by the building inspector and that have not been material modified since the final inspection. And the effective date, liability applies only to inspections made after the effective date of the bill, which is the normal effective date of the bill, of any bill, I believe, which would be, in this case, January 1st. 2002, yeah.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm shocked to find out, I've been here since 1997. This may be the first time I've had a bill that somebody didn't like. or maybe not.
I just didn't say it.
colleagues were... Let me state on the outside that I think this thing is subject to amendment, and I'm not necessarily opposed to that. For example, I'm not sure that the inspector should be the one with the liability, and maybe the department in which the inspector works should ultimately have the liability. And I think it should also be stated in here that the contractor certainly is the first course of action, not the inspector, but there are those cases where contractors and subcontractors tend to disappear from time to time. Where this came from basically is, as I've looked over time over the last 30 years at the increasing cost in inspections to build a home, to where, you know, and I understand inflation and all those things that increase costs, but if you compare what the total amount of that you pay for inspections on home construction now to 30 years ago, it's gone up way beyond cost of living. And so I start wondering what in the world we're getting for all of this, and what we're getting theoretically is an inspection, but then I start asking where is the accountability in it, and currently there really is none unless a person was willing to take the city or the municipality to court and try to get resolution that way, and that I think is somewhat cumbersome. You know, and actually, folks, where this really started from was when I built my ex-wife's house back in the 70s. Actually, she wasn't my ex-wife at the time, but because that would be really foolish to do something like that.
Ex-wife to be.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be one hell of a divorce settlement, I tell you. You know, and we had all the inspections and all that, and we moved into the house and turned everything on, and lo and behold, we had a leak. We had a joint that wasn't soldered. Well, certainly it's the responsibility of the contractor for that, but you know, we had an inspection that should have uncovered that and didn't, and so I'm wondering, you know, these folks can make the inspections and walk away clean because the liability falls elsewhere. Several folks have come and talked to me about this and with some valid concerns, and I'm willing to kind of take those concerns into consideration, but one of the things that was said to me was if we have this standard, it's going to take a lot longer to do the inspection because they're going to have to look at everything. And I'm thinking to myself, aren't they supposed to anyway? You know, if the inspections are being done the right way, theoretically it wouldn't add an increased burden. It maybe it would add a little bit more due diligence in the process. So, like I say, I think there are some amendments that probably need to happen to this bill. I think the concept is good simply because we are holding government responsible for the things that they are guaranteeing. And with that, I'll let people rip me apart.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Cruz. This afternoon you get to, Mr. Chair. Okay. I have several people on a list here. First is Joe Schweinhart from League of Oregon Cities. Next up will be Bill Cross, and in the hole is Art Schlack from AOC.
They're all supporting this. Is that
what's that? No, they don't need to come up together. I'm just letting.
Oh no, I was just wondering if they're all supporting it.
Oh, no.
Oh.
And they're all from less than 50 miles away. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman Cromwell, and honorable members of the committee. My name is Joe Schweinhart. I am the League of Oregon Cities Legislative Director. I'm here to speak about House Bill 2517, which addresses a very important issue to cities and its citizens, that being building inspections. Well-qualified inspectors do a great job inspecting structures. If this bill passes, it would have terrible consequences on how things are done in building inspections. It seems to be an attempt to shift responsibility away from those responsible for doing the work, to the inspector's inspection of the structure. If a jurisdiction does not adopt an ordinance to hold the inspectors harmless for something they honestly missed during inspection, we would have a difficult time getting those inspectors. And the ones we could manage to keep would not be able to exercise discretion on any common sense items. We would see very few timely inspections. This bill doesn't seem to take into account that those doing the work have the primary responsibility and accountability for doing the work correctly, and that the inspectors there provide the best oversight possible, given his or her constraints at the time. Mr. Chairman, those are my remarks. I just wanted to let you know where, you know, the city see a potential serious problem with this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Schweinhart? Representative Hill?
Thank you. So how are cities that are handling building inspections, how are they making sure that the inspectors sort of quality control? I mean, because if the job of the inspector is to inspect the job and make sure that they're up to building code, and then you have an event that it wasn't, I mean, is the city liable today under existing statutes and the fact that they allowed a building to be constructed that wasn't up to code. I'm just trying to understand in terms of relationship and sort of in how you police yourself and, you know, do quality control on the work that's occurring today.
Chairman Crummell, Representative Hill, I think obviously it comes down to individuals. You know, you have a house inspected, you have qualified inspectors doing the work. Are there people going behind the inspectors and checking and double-checking? No. But it's like anything. You have qualified people doing the job. They're doing the job well. You don't have those complaints. Obviously, the homeowner, if he has a problem, it will come forward very quickly. Now, to what degree the inspector plays into that problem is another question. I mean, there are certain constraints. When he goes in there to inspect the home, he may not have every opportunity to see everything that's in the home. I mean, part of that home is being built as you go along. So they are inspecting the best they can for the time they're there. I think one of the scary parts of this is, I mean, if you hold the inspector strictly responsible, then as an inspector, I would want to be there and start almost tearing through walls to make sure that things are done correctly to protect myself. And right now, I think there is, all cities have a liability coverage to handle, obviously, wrongful actions by any of their city employees.
Representative Smith.
Thank you very much. In your comments, you said there would be very few timely inspections. What do you base that on? Why would this affect that?
Chairman Crummell, Representative Smith. The reason for that, like I just spoke, was that the inspectors would have to spend a lot of time with some of these inspections, or most of these inspections, just for the fact that they'd be scared that they would be held strictly responsible for some things that, anybody could come forward with some type of complaint when they go after the inspector. So they'd have to be doubly careful to make sure that even small items, they'd have to inspect closely.
Yes, a follow-up.
So are you saying they're not doing that now?
No, what I'm saying is when they go in turn to inspect, they're doing the inspection the best they can at the time they have. On an individual basis, they're doing the best job they can with the constraints they have, which is depending on an individual basis of the house. Now, are they doing small inspections, everything? They're doing inspections according to the code.
Follow-up? Go ahead.
What would the constraints be?
Well, when they go in to inspect certain parts of the house or to make sure that the water's running correctly or whatever, there may be parts of that whole construction of that water system they wouldn't be able to see, the plumbing. So they, you know, there are certain ways they can go in there and inspect, but they can't see everything.
And you think this would hold them too liable?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Ward?
So I just want to make sure that I got an understanding right. You would testify that that existing liability law is covering contractors and government agencies that currently are in existence provide sufficient recourse for aggravated parties.
I can't sit here and say no in certain terms that's true. But I know there are insurance by cities that cover such things.
Thank you.
Representative Girard?
In the case where you had a city building inspector who inspected a city building project, who would be liable?
Chairman Crummell, Representative Yard. I mean, if it's a city structure, it's a city an inspector doing the inspection, I guess the city would be.
So it's city versus city on the same project.
Same project.
Or county project, whatever. We just built two buildings in Klamath County, and the building inspector forgot to check that there wasn't any disabled mechanisms available in the building, which turned out to be the architect's problem,
mm-hmm.
but nonetheless made the county liable.
Mm-hmm.
So it brings up an interesting situation.
Very much so. And, you know, whoever, like I said, there's architects and there's also the builder himself.
Correct.
Who's supposed to be following and putting those systems in.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Trump?
You made a comment, you know, it's Representative Worth's question, that you couldn't say that there was sufficient liability. You couldn't make that, the existing liability was sufficient. So, I mean, is the direction we might take on this, rather than strict liability, rather a nice thing that says, you know, local jurisdictions shall, you know, have appropriate liability coverage? I mean, I'm just curious, and I don't know what that is. You made the comment that you couldn't say for sure, and I'm just...
But Chairman Crummell and Representative Hill, the reason I said that is because I'm not personally sure. Maybe somebody that's going to testify after me could give those comments better and would know better than I would.
Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much time do you think an average building inspector would spend inspecting a building, a house?
Representative Crummell, Representative Tomei, it would just depend on the house. I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I honestly don't know how much time it would take.
Thank you.
Depends also probably on what he found. You know, if there were
just wonder if there's an average that a building inspector would assume it would take to inspect a single family home.
It would probably depend on the home.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is Bill Cross. On deck is Art Schlack, and in the hole is Joe Brewer.
Mr. Chair, are we going to use baseball terms all session?
Hey, we got spring training. It's just around the corner.
Go Yankees.
I hope we're not here for the World Series.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today representing the Oregon Building Officials Association. I'm distributing a copy of a draft that legal counsel did for the for Washington County, and it highlights some concerns we have in terms of the this new standard of liability that would be created, a strict standard of liability which goes beyond the current negligence standard and would hold the individual employee liable as well as the current standard of the there again the employer, the entity providing those inspection services typically is liable for the actions of their employees. And if their employees are negligent, currently there is an action that can be taken against them. The problem with inspections, and I think some of you have asked some very good questions, the builders and building designers in this state are required to design and build buildings according to code, according to statewide code adopted by the Building Codes Division. The state and local jurisdictions who assume those programs are supposed to enforce that code. And in doing so, it's partnering with the building design community and the construction industry, because the codes are very complex. And typically, if an inspector is going to inspect a building, they will spot check. They won't check all the beams in the building. They'll check several to see if they're being built to code. They won't check all the solders, all the joints in a plumbing system. They will check some of them to see if they are being built to code. There is not really an average time of inspection for, you know, a 1,400 square foot residential residence, because they're again depending on the contractor and their sensitivity to the current code requirements. You may find that they don't need as many re-inspections as a contractor that may not be as familiar with the code requirements. You will look, though, at a single-family one- and two-family dwelling residence. They'll take anywhere from 16 to 20 inspections just because you do it along the way. Each, you know, the foundation, the structure, the framing, I mean, all different steps have to be inspected as they're being done. So there are numerous inspections, plus if significant problems are found, they'll go back to re-inspect to ensure that those changes have been made. There is no assurance that under the way this inspection process works that you would catch, you know, all instances because of the amount of time it would take to inspect all beams or all joints. It just is not possible. So typically they will inspect to determine whether or not they're meeting the basic code requirements. They'll maybe spend more time on fire life safety issues. But we even have in this state a process where because of the timeliness our customers have asked for in inspections, we now have programs such as minor labels. And minor labels allow electrical and plumbing contractors, for example, to buy a permit and they can go out and do 10 minor plumbing activities or electrical activities without having a separate permit for each one of those, without having each one inspected. They will instead be spot checked. There again, if they determine that the contractor on those spot checks isn't doing them according to code, they will then go back and routinely inspect more of their activities, and in fact they could lose their privilege to get minor labels if in fact they don't on a routine basis then do them properly. So we have, because of the nature of the code requirements and the inspections, and time is money, and so when you're a builder out there trying to complete a project, we're trying to find the balance between ensuring buildings are going to meet code and being built safely, yet allowing that contractor to move forward on a building and get them done in some sort of reasonable time frame. And our concern about the bill would be that it may, or presumably would, impact the amount of time required to inspect, which would also impact the cost to the builders and the building owners. And what we might achieve from that would be, you sort of meet a point of diminishing returns. And how thorough your inspections are, you want to kind of hit that point where as it starts to diminish, you're moving on to the next project. And this is a program that has evolved over years. If, in fact, the legislature wants to require more detailed inspections, that's certainly something that obviously we will do, but it will have its costs, and it will require additional resources to accomplish that. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hill?
Thank you. Bill, is there any problems in the process in the system today?
Chair Crummell, Representative Hill, are there any problems? Yes, there are problems. Maintaining, and I think you may have asked the question earlier, how do you maintain accountability with inspectors? We provide a lot of ongoing training and education to continue to try and enhance their skills, to continue to enhance their code awareness. We also do the same. The building community does the same. The trades do the same. There's a lot of money spent on training and education to try and keep raising the threshold of awareness of what the code requires. We do have some checks and balances, and a certified inspector, if in fact they abuse their, if they're found negligent, and if their certification can be suspended or revoked. In fact, the building officials are working with BC, the Building Codes Division, on trying to develop a progressive sanction so that you could work with some of the inspectors who maybe are identified as having had some problems.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hill.
Do we have a number? How many inspectors have sort of been put into remedial building inspector school or had problems or something or had their certificate or license or whatever it is? Well, I'm trying to get a universe here. Are we talking about 3 people? Are we talking about 500 people? Is this a common issue? I mean, you know, when somebody's house falls down, you know, there's a problem. And you can sort of say maybe that it's a culpable between the contractor. And then you also have to say and look at the inspector saying, well, somebody signed it and said it was okay.
Chair Crummell, Representative Hill. First, the extent of these situations where it's actually led to unsafe buildings or buildings built outside of code that have created or caused damages is very limited. I do not know how many of those cases, but certainly in recent time, I am aware of several. One of them, which I think fits the scenario Representative Cruz was addressing, wherein usually the contractor is liable. Sometimes the building designers can be liable. In this case, the contractor had gone bankrupt, so the customer, the homeowner, didn't have a resource, and they named the city, and the city did agree to settle with the owner because in this case they were able to, the final inspection, the inspector who did the final inspection was negligent and overlooked some of the earlier required changes and thought they had been done and they hadn't. That's really the only case I know that sort of fits this scenario. Oregon has pretty high standards, and I don't know of at least too many that have gone into the legal arenas to resolve these kinds of issues. In terms of certifications and actions taken against certificate holders, in recent history, I know of only one where the individual certifications have been removed. But part of that problem has been, I think, the Building Codes Division has felt they only have one sort of action. If somebody is negligent, they can really either suspend or revoke, and they've been hesitant to do that. And we, this last interim, identified and have been working with the Building Codes Division in working on a progressive sanctions approach where, for example, right now, if you're a licensed plumber and or unlicensed plumber, but violate the law, well, you go before the plumbing board, and if it's your first offense, depending on how, you know, egregious it is, you may pay, you know, a fine. Next time around, it may be a larger fine. Third time around, you may be suspended from using your license. And we're suggesting that that same approach with, you know, remedial sanctions should be applied to certificate holders based on their, again, the extent of their actions and how, whether they were, you know, intentional or simply, a situation of negligence that we can address for remedial training versus, wait a minute, that person probably needs to find another career.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Clark. I have a comment and then a question. Attitude adjustment would be a real needed thing in the inspector. Some of these inspectors that are on these jobs are not very good to work. So maybe that's part of the problem, too, is the way they come onto the job, and that's just for my own comment. But you talked about the minor labels program, so I'm assuming not all inspections are being done. There's spot checking. Is this a statewide or is this county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, this is a statewide law, and it's done voluntarily in counties and cities. It's mandated in the tri-county area. They have a mandatory minor labor program, and it actually works quite well. You also have, in fact, a scenario where I think this committee may later this session see a bill to sunset repeal or to extend a pilot project that's been done with the home builders on a program called Master Builder. And there again, if they've passed a higher level of training on codes and have demonstrated that they've got certain financial, you know, bonding levels and whatnot, they're able to do some self-inspection on certain aspects of the building. Ones that are considered, you know, less life-threatening or you know, like the sheetrock inspection. So far, the builders haven't done the self-inspections. They prefer having an inspector come in, but we're doing that in partnership, as I say, with the industry because of the limited resources and the time it takes to conduct inspections. And if you've got somebody that is sensitive and code knowledgeable and trying to build or design to code, you typically have less inspection problems than somebody that's, you know, still working on 1973 codes and we've got big problems and it takes a lot longer in the field to obviously then get that building inspected. So we'd like to see a more, you know, less inspections, frankly, if assuming that the builder is code aware, you know, knowledgeable about the codes and building according to the codes.
Representative Worth.
Mr. Cross, how would this, in your opinion, shift the liability of the builder or the contractor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I don't think it would shift it at all. The contractor or the building designer are still going to be named in a suit. They're still liable. They didn't build according to code, and that's their responsibility. That's what their license requires. So they would still be named. Typically, I think, because the perception of the homeowner or the building owner would be that they're in it for a profit, that's probably, you know, who they're going to think has the deep pockets. Unfortunately, we do have instances where the builders are here today and gone tomorrow, and that's typically then when you may see the jurisdiction named as well. But I don't think this will shift liability. I think it would, if in fact the employee were added to this chain of liability, it might add another, you know, respondent to the suit. I don't think it's going to be a very deep pocket, frankly, because most of these employees are not going to have the wherewithal. It may require jurisdictions to go out and get personal errors and omissions or some, you know, additional insurance for individual employees as opposed to what they now have in terms of their tort coverage as employing as employers. I don't know, and that's an area I don't have the legal background to quite understand how that could be addressed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Also, in your opinion, the inspectors are there, it's their responsibility to ensure that the builders are complying with codes, applicable codes and standards. So I guess I'm looking at this, I don't want to put a label on it, but a kind of a hand-holding type of inspector. And what would that eventually do or an overall big picture impact to the role of codes and standards and the role that they play in the building codes and the standards? If the inspector is there and ultimately liable for everything, doesn't that diminish the role of the actual building codes and standards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I don't think it would. Obviously, those standards are going to be more rigidly applied to the highest level of interpretation. And interestingly, ILA person thought, you know, the codes are pretty black and white, and you know, you can do it this way, you can't do it any other way type of thing. But there's actually a lot of interpretive analysis that goes into the codes, and in fact they allow for alternative means and methods to be utilized by an inspector to achieve certain goals, and so there can be sometimes alternate means proved. So it's not quite as black and white, and if you were to hold the individual inspector strictly liable, they're going to always err on the most conservative approach or the highest level of interpretation of that particular, you know, code provision, which may or may not be excessive. If you look at the total billing, it may be excessive. That one provision may be excessive because here's what the builder has done in other areas that meet the total goal of having a safe building.
What I get from you is I look at this as diminishing the clear and objective building codes and standards, in that the ultimate say is the inspector's interpretation, and therefore more of a discretionary type decision than the clear and objective standards, the more black and white, less reliance on those amongst builders.
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I think it would have just the opposite. I think there would be less interpretive analysis going on in the field, and it would be more, we'll find out what the black and white is, and we'll find out what the highest degree
stream.
Exactly, to protect ourselves. And as I say, that will add some building costs because right now they do have the ability to approve alternative means or methods and materials, and they're not going to do that if they know they could be at some point held strictly liable.
Final question.
Yes, Representative.
And I will ask you the same question I asked the previous testifying. Would you say that existing liability laws covering contractors and government agencies provide sufficient recourse for aggravated parties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I would say that is probably the case, but there again, representing the building officials, I don't know all of the, you know, legal cases that may have been filed against cities or counties or the state. I've only heard about two or three that have actually gone somewhere, and in those cases, yes, it's been adequate. But as I say, I don't know enough about maybe other claims that are out there. So that's sort of my perception, but I don't want to say definitively yes.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next up is Art Schlack, and on deck is Joe Brewer, and in the hole is Ralph Brunner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And you've heard testimony already this morning, so I don't want to go back over some of that territory at this point. But we do have a concern with respect to changing the standard from one, at least as it relates to counties, of showing in a building inspector that negligence was the standard for filing a suit, to one of strict liability, which means basically that something occurred. And so the standard at this point would be much less, and likely you would see more suits filed against local government as part of also filing the suit against either the engineer, architect, or the builder at this point. Right now, since the standard is one of negligence, that's a little harder to show than it is just the fact that, you know, there was a problem. For instance, there's a leak. Was there negligence on the part of the inspector? This bill brings with it likely increases, as I indicated, in lawsuits to not only the local government, potentially the state, because the state in many areas of the state at this point does the building inspections. So this is not just local government here. This is state of Oregon as well as cities and counties that do building inspections. Part of the testimony of Mr. Cross related to the fact that there's impacts dealing with need for more time to conduct inspections, the need for more inspectors, as well as increases in fees. And these are unintended consequences, I'm sure, at this point. But when you raise the level of liability and also extend it to the individual, there will be consequences with respect to all three of those things that will come into play. The final thing that I would like to note for you is I've indicated this is a kind of building inspection program is kind of a partnership between the state and local governments. And the state, through the building codes, has encouraged local governments, especially counties, to take over building programs, because where a county does not or a city does not undertake those programs, they fall to the state. And as a result of this bill in changing the standards, I would submit to you that counties will reevaluate their programs, their ability to provide the service and the liability they have, and in some cases, maybe not all, return those to the state. And so the state then will be providing programs where in areas of the state where they have encouraged, suggested that counties and local government undertake those. So that, too, is an unintended consequence, potentially, and would have an impact of the state of Oregon at this point. With that, Mr. Chairman, that would complete my testimony, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to respond to those.
Any questions? Representative Gerard.
All right, I just really, it's not really a question, Mr. Chairman, but to concur with the fact that if this were to pass, as a former commissioner, I can certainly tell you we would send this right back to the state and say we're getting out of the inspection business.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Let's see. Next up is Joe Brewer, and on deck is Ralph Bruner.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator at the Building Codes Division. I had prepared written testimony, but I'm not going to pass that out because I found it contains a technical flaw. I think we can follow up, get that clarified, and distribute written testimony later on if that's okay with the chair. I'd like to go and to explaining a little bit about the system of our construction regulation in our state. It was characterized as a partnership, and it really is a partnership that creates the well-worn analogy of a three-legged stool. Training of licensed trades, licensed contractors is a big element in that process. The statewide code sets a minimum and maximum standard that cannot be amended locally. Oregon has enjoyed that statewide standard since 1973, and it was very progressive when Oregon made that move. It was one of the first three or four states to make that move. And finally, permitting an inspection. Part of that process is the training of certified inspectors, the ongoing continuing education, and in fact, the requirement in our state that an inspector have some experience in the field doing the work, going to Representative Smith's issue about attitude on the job. It's very important for an inspector to understand how to carry himself or herself on a job in order to gain the cooperation of a contractor, an architect, design professional in the process. There was some discussion earlier about Senate Bill 512, minor label program. That's an issue that Representative March is very familiar with, having worked with the division on the Tri-County legislation from last session and the Master Builder Pilot Program that I'll come back to. The structure of Oregon's system is such that cities get first option in administering a program. Counties have second choice if they would like to administer a building inspection program. The state administers everything that's left. So we inspect rural Oregon. We serve no population center. We serve about 9% of the population of the state of Oregon. A lot of windshield time. Average inspections, I've been out on inspections with inspectors that range from a 10-minute stop to a two-hour hand-holding session with a homeowner that's building his own addition. So there's a very wide range of inspection activities. The building code requires 7 specific inspections, but I can tell you from personal experience, many other inspections can and are requested in the process. There's been discussion of the standard of liability. That's where our technical flaw in our testimony was identified. We understand the current test to be negligence. We understand the change that this bill would create to be basically liability without proof of fault in that respect. The change may be costly. The state performed 68,000 inspections statewide last year. As I've already stated, we serve about 10% of the population, so you get some sense of what the numbers are in terms of this activity. Our concern is that the bill may, if passed, reduce the use of judgment in the field. It's been our experience when we identify a problem inspector, a problem jurisdiction, it has a lot to do with the absence of judgment in the field, the absence of exercising fair interpretation skills in terms of what the code requires. And finally, going to Mr. Schlack's point, we are concerned more programs would be returned to the state. In our enforcement actions, in our oversight activities, we've tried to emphasize identifying problem areas, providing support, remedial action rather than revoking certifications. There have been a number of such incidents. We were involved in the issue that Representative Garrard identified in Klamath County. A new building official came into that jurisdiction, asked for our help, and we worked, I believe it was a community center or a care center where the accessibility issues were identified. The issue that Representative Cruz spoke to, the leak in a residence, those issues can be addressed simply by requiring final inspections. A final inspection would identify that issue. In fact, we're aware some jurisdictions, frankly, don't get to those final inspections, may have been the case in your particular instance. The Master Builder Program was described earlier. The move in our state has been away from a high degree, a high presence of regulation to more of a cooperative self-certification approach. The Minor Label Program is a good example. Trained, qualified, licensed contractors and workers can get a sheet of 10 labels, do the work, send the labels in. We send the inspection request out to a jurisdiction, we look at 1 in 10. And when we identify a problem contractor, we work with that contractor, with the jurisdiction, and can go as far as removing that contractor's ability to get the labels. The Master Builder Pilot Program, in fact, in Salem and Marion County was very successful. We learned that contractors, given the opportunity to learn more about the codes, do produce better quality documents, do in fact create the need for fewer corrections to be written in the field, and don't in fact exercise that discretionary ability to self-certify, looking for the inspector to come in and be that objective third set of eyes on the project. I want to leave the committee with one thing. Inspection is not the catch-all for every flaw in a project. Inspectors go in, look for key issues, look for the life safety issues, the things that matter most. And with 18 or 20 inspections a day, many inspectors simply don't have time to spend the hours on a job site they might like to spend. So that's our system. That's how we administer it. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Brewer? Representative March?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brewer, how many inspectors does the state have? And then how many inspectors roughly would the rest of the jurisdictions have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, my recollection is that the state has in the neighborhood of 50 inspectors. Frankly, I'd like to go back to the division and get exact numbers, get those back to Representative March and to all the committee members through the administrator, if that would be okay. I don't want to give you a number and then have to explain why that number changed.
Sure.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see, bat and cleanup, Ralph Gruner. No remarks. I can see it coming.
It's better to be in a hole, isn't it, Ralph?
Yeah, especially.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Gruner, representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and actually I'm the junior member of our lobby team, and as a result, I've been assigned the whole world of inspection, and my blood pressure has been up for the last 8 years. That's why I want to say a few things to clarify more than management has, a few about my members that we're talking about. Because when you are talking about building inspectors, for the most part in Oregon, you're talking AFSCME. By that, I mean the state agency, but also I look at your cities and your counties. And by the way, in your city, the city of Portland, you have four times the amount of inspectors that the state of Oregon does. I'm sorry we don't have your city, Wilsonville, but West Glen we do. So part of your district we do. But I know where you're from, and I would like to speak in behalf of the members. One, let me start this way, and it's hard to teach this stuff in 30 seconds. Frankly, I was a young legislator in 1973 when we passed the state building codes that meant that, in fact, all cities and counties in the state would be oversee the system of building codes, and we were one of, if not the first, state in America to take that step. That was a session, by the way, that a lot of bills passed, some you might call egregious and others popular. Hopefully this one is popular with most folks. But you need to understand that Oregon has been a leader in the state building codes arena and that we do have national standards and so forth. But just a few, and then I served, when I left here, I became, a county commissioner for, 8 years in Clackamas County. So I had firsthand knowledge of building inspection because I was once again the junior commissioner and was assigned that department. And so the fact of the matter is, then I came down here to lobby, and we went, just several sessions ago, passed Senate Bill 35, which was really an update of what we had done in 73 by saying the state building division truly has oversight over local jurisdictions and will inspect to make sure that those cities and counties are providing a quality, competent system and put some teeth in it. I served on that task force, and that took us almost an entire session just to work Senate Bill 35 out. And then last session, we passed Senate Bill 587, which was a work of compromise and give and take. And we came out with a bill that said, for example, the private sector inspection, many of your inspectors that contract, cities and counties contract with our private sector, they didn't have the errors and omissions until Senate Bill 587. That came up here until Senate Bill 587 required that last session, and we supported that measure. But one of the problems we face so that you can get to the bottom line of 20 years, which no one's done with you, there are differences in opinion on this whole arena, and I may as well give them to you right up front. The fact is, the builders and development interest in this building are not my enemies, by the way. They're my friends on 99% of this. The fact of the matter is, and rightfully so, they want to be able to come in to wherever they live, and they want to be able to get to your building division, and they want to be able to, in some kind of timely fashion that's reasonable, get that building permit out, because that's driven by the economics, as you understand, of that situation. On the other hand, we have folks who tell us, my God, how are we supposed to get plumbing, and I'm using plumbing, electrical inspectors for the kind of salary you offer, especially at the state level. So we had problems, and major problems, in that our folks who were plumbing electrical inspectors at the state level said, why am I going to, they're a registered plumber, they're a rectal electrician. So they were leaving in droves to go to the private sector, back to the trades, or they were going to cities and counties that paid a much higher salary. So I do need you to understand that when you see me in this building trying to get salaries up for our state inspectors in fee bills, it's totally related to the question of quality, because we not only need to be able to compete with cities and counties and the private sector, but we need to compete in salary, but we need to compete. We provide currently continuing education. My members are ongoing continuing education, both federal building codes and at the state level, which I think they do an admirable job since they're my agency that I represent. If they weren't, I might not say admirable. I would have said something else. But at any rate, there are those in this building who would like to reduce standards of inspectors, which I would hope, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that your same fervor for this measure would oppose, primarily because if we begin reducing standards of certification of inspectors, what we've really done is reduce those standards at the expense of, at least in AFSCME's opinion, of the public. And we don't see the Consumer League very active in Oregon anymore, I'm sorry to say, but this is a big issue. Just look at the earthquakes that are going on around the world, and you should be very happy, I would hope, that we do have the standards in America and in Oregon that we have, even above those national standards. So we oppose measures to reduce standards. Now, the building officials will have problems in that they have a hard time getting qualified staff to take these jobs in their behalf. On the one hand, I like everyone, by the way. My style is to try to understand everyone's problem and understand that I've got to come in the middle and become some kind of facilitator to resolve it. That's my style. So the fact of the matter is, on the one hand, I got building officials saying we don't reduce the standards of folks, then we don't privatize more. How are we going to provide the service to the builder and the public, building a home or a facility, and keep the economy going? Because the first thing that shows a weakening economy, by the way, and we knew this, what, 3 months ago? The economists didn't need to tell us in the business. We knew the economy was softening because every county in Oregon except Washington counties, building permits were down. So we knew the economy was softening, and we knew ultimately that was going to affect you here in your programs in Salem this session. So what is this all about? We're against this bill because what we've done, we feel, is pick my members, who are wonderful people, work very, very hard at their job to do a good job. They work on their certification. To tie them to some kind of personal litigation above the current negligent standards the Attorney General says we have. Now, to me, all this is balance. Everything in this building is balance. And the fact is, if you trip that scale of justice a bit this way versus this way, what you've done, and you've already heard the testimony, potentially, I can't say that, because it potentially increased time, problems, giving up, former commissioner stated, of that, their program. By the way, those are our members in your area as well, back to the state. So what we'll end up with is a state running around trying to inspect more rural areas, and by the way, even doing it, I would go from an effective to a very ineffective. So bottom line, I'll shut up. We walk a fine line between protection of the public and the remonstrances of the industry to get the job done in a timely fashion. If you all understand what I just said, you have encapsulated the battle that will go on in this building this entire session and every session you serve. So there, Mr. Chair, I've completed my timely work, and I appreciate your comments and questions.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hill.
I was going to vote for the bill until that, right? That I could not support the bill. So, I'm sorry, Jeff. You know, there it is. That was compelling.
You're a wonderful. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Drummer?
Thank you.
Okay. I don't have anybody else on the list come up and speak. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak? Thank you very much. Before I close the public hearing on this bill, I realize that I forgot to allow committee members the opportunity to ask Representative Cruz any questions. We just went right into the testimony.
Okay.
So what I'd like to know is that are there any questions for Representative Cruz?
I don't think that I have questions. I don't think they're appropriate to this.
I just have a couple of questions that I'd like to ask the representative. If the structure complied, the inspector went in, everything was the way it was supposed to be, with the building and specialty codes, and then it failed. The structure failed. Whether it's the building falls down, the plumbing falls apart, electrical catches fire, whatever the case may be, under this bill would the inspector still be liable?
And, Mr. Chair, I think probably under this bill, yes, but there were several things that were brought up here today. Statute of limitations on, I think, certainly being one. I mean, I don't think you can expect anybody to be held to what happens to a building when it's 30 years old. Another issue that I think is important that's not addressed in the bill is the position of liability of the inspectors. And whether it's the inspectors of the department who has the liability, and Representative Hill brought up the issue of strict liability, and maybe there's another standard. Ultimately, what we're trying to get to here is to give homeowners a clear track of recourse in the event that there is a failure in the time frame that would be appropriate to construction. and it should also be very clear that we are looking for those cases where the contractor is no longer there to be liable. So those are the areas that still need to be addressed in any amendments that this bill would go under.
Okay, thank you. With regards to limitations, I know that the local governments are under a $50,000 limitation for their government and employees. Is it your proposal that this would that this bill would expand that limitation?
It's not my proposal. No.
Okay.
Whether it does or not, I don't know.
Okay. I just want to make sure. And then,
simple country boy, we're getting way beyond me.
Okay. And Representative March, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Cruz. If your concern is the liability and the cost to the owner or whatever, wouldn't it be better to maybe set up some sort of liability fund that would indemnify people in the future?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I came into this, and all my friends out here who were just eager as hell to jump all over me, and I said, I'm open to anything on this. So, Bill's right. This is not really a major issue, but it is something of concern, and it needs to be addressed in the appropriate manner. This is certainly not make or break legislation for this session. I don't think we are identified by this bill. God, I hope we're not. But
okay, Representative Smith.
I have a question for Representative.
Yes.
Under this bill, where you have a mechanical inspection, a plumbing inspection, then there's a final inspection. Which inspector would be held?
Well, that wasn't really addressed either. I think the plumbing inspector would probably be held in this bill, should have been held liable for the plumbing, because the final inspection, the walls are up, and how can they, the final on the plumbing is when it's bare studs and they can see everything.
But the final inspector is signing off that he's done the final,
The final inspector is signing off on the process, and there's an act of faith that the other inspections were done appropriately.
And I agree with you. Something needs to be done about this.
Any other questions? Representative Red?
I would thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to congratulate Representative Cruz for seeing a need of increased accountability in a safety area, but I don't think this is the right way to go.
Thank you. I would invite anyone who is willing to work with Representative Cruz on this as far as amendments and that sort of thing are concerned. And then when you have the appropriate types of amendments done, Representative Cruz, I would entertain the idea of having another hearing. One thing I would like to just follow up on very quickly, and that's a comment or a question that Representative Smith made, and I think that one thing that we need to recognize in state government and as well as local governments and any level of government that I've ever been in, I've harped on this, and that's realizing customer service is of most importance. And when our inspectors go out, they need to make sure that they put their best foot forward and that they don't treat the customer like they're an interruption in their day. And also that they even if they are on a power trip, for God's sakes, don't let the customer know that they're on a power trip, because that's one of the ways that I think our government employees get kind of a bad name. And so I would just remind folks of that. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2517. And let's see,
we're not going to work session?
No, we won't go into work session. We conceptually amend this. And without objection, we are adjourned.